Renee Brinkerhoff is a rally race car driver, something she took up in her mid-50s. Believe it or not, she knew nothing about being a race car driver and had no real desire to be one. But she followed a 30-year urge and now owns her own team, Valkyrie Racing. Renee recalls her first race at La Carrera Panamerica in Mexico, one of the most dangerous racing events in the world.
Literally, it was so frightening that I was shaking uncontrollably. So I would be at the start and they'd be counting down the clock. And you're watching it go from 9, 8, 7, 6, you know, on the seconds. And you know you're going to be going flat out. And you know you're on a dangerous road. And you know there's a lot of unknowns, right? And you know you have no experience and you don't know what you're doing.
Renee experienced some success and notoriety in the business and thought it was time to give back.
You know, we have this little voice and we have a heart for change. So how can we couple those together and have a bigger voice and have a bigger impact for change? And so that's how we created Project 356. So we decided to take the car on a global stage and put it in environments where there'd never, ever been that kind of car before, or never been a woman before, or whatever combination of those firsts that we could come up with.
Project 356 aims to raise awareness and funds to combat child trafficking. Renee's 1956 Porsche 356A, hence the name Project 356, has been to all but one continent. The trip to Antarctica is scheduled for December 2021 after being delayed by COVID. Owner of Valkyrie Racing, Renee Brinkerhoff, on this episode of Run It Like a Girl.
Really excited today to be broadcasting from my studio here in rural Ontario, where I have the great pleasure of speaking with Renee Brinkerhoff, founder of Valkyrie Racing. Renee, thank you so much for joining us for an episode.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
Oh, I'm very excited about this. So I think we're just going to dive right in. I'd love to start with your background. You didn't grow up racing cars. So how and why did you decide that this was what you were going to do?
Concerning both the things I'm doing in my life right now, I say that they chose me. I didn't choose them. And so if we first talk about the racing, it was really a have to, not a want to. And I had this realization one day that I'd been having a conversation with myself for 25, 30 years. And it was so subconscious that I didn't even know that I'd been having it until I heard my voice in my head. And it was, one day I'm going to race a car. And for whatever reason, I'd been telling myself that for umpteen years. And when I realized what I'd been saying, it was a shock. I was not excited about it. I did not have any inclination or desire to go do that. Or in fact, I was super disappointed and mad at myself for having said that, but I knew that if I'd been saying that all those years, I had to go do it. For whatever reason, I'd been saying that there was a reason and I had to go do it. And that's just how it all began.
So that's so interesting to me. And I love it because I think a lot of times people, you know, they might have that, I have to go do this, but then they don't go do it, which is a real shame. And I think it's a great credit to you that you have done this. And also the fact that you started doing this, you know, not as a 20-year-old woman, but further along. I think that's remarkable. And I think because, you know, I think people get different images in their head when they think of race car driver and what that means and the styles of racing and the variety that there is out there. Can you tell us a little bit about kind of what you do, the type of racing that you do, and a bit about your profession doing that?
Sure. So when I had that epiphany, I was probably 55, 56 years old, and I didn't know anything about racing or the kinds of racing. So part of this whole quest of fulfilling that was learning about the kinds of racing. And when I heard about rally racing, I just thought, that's it. I'm sort of one of those people that when something just sort of all the lights turn on, it's like, that's what I want to do. And so rally racing, unlike driving on a track or, you know, NASCAR racing or Formula racing or something like that, it's on roads. And it can be dirt roads, gravel, mud, sand, paved, whatever, and depends upon the event. And sometimes they close those roads so that there shouldn't be any oncoming traffic or whatever might be out there, right? Or they're open. It just depends. Sometimes you are racing with oncoming cars, etc. There's always things that animals and unforeseen things of, you know, flash flooding, you know, land, you know, slides coming off the mountains or whatever, things that are in the road that weren't there when they decided to do that section of road that happened that night or the morning of, or so there's all those unforeseen things, and you have a navigator. That's the other part. So you're on these roads, and if you could imagine in your mind, if you're in your favorite car and you've got all the time in the world and it's amazing and you wish, gosh, I wish I could just put my foot down on that pedal, go as fast as I want and not have to worry about oncoming traffic, not have to worry about the police and just enjoy this moment. That's the kind of racing that it is. And in addition to having those types of roads, you have a navigator. So rally racing requires a navigator. And there's, and again, within rally racing, there's all different kinds. There's kinds that are just like very precise. You have to be here at a certain time and it's only this certain top speed. You can't go higher than that top speed. I think that's called time distance, but this is the kind of rally racing where you go flat out and it's the fastest person that wins. And you have a navigator, and a navigator has a book with information about what's coming up on the road ahead. And they call out cues to you to imagine not what you're seeing, but what you don't see. So you can drive what's coming up. So around that corner, what's it going to be? Is it going to be 2 kilometers of flat, straight out roads where we're going to go as fast as we dare? Or is it going to be 3 or 4 more turns after that where I'm going to have to slow down and we're going to have to execute all these turns? So they'll say like left 2 or right 4, 50 meters followed by. So it's all these kinds of, it's a whole different language of cues that tell you how to prepare for what's ahead.
That's fascinating. So you must have to have a good relationship with your navigator and put a lot of trust in them as well.
That's a huge understatement. I've seen people fighting on the side of the road and won't get back into the car with each other because they're either going too fast or too slow or just personality conflict. So you really have to have a great connection with that person in the car with you. You're under a lot of stress all day long. Racing in itself is super stressful and dangerous, right? So yeah, you had better have a great rapport with that person because yeah, there could definitely be a lot of conflict.
I bet, and because we are talking about thousands of miles sometimes, these races.
Sometimes thousands of miles, and it could be 2 or 3 days. It could be 36 days. Depends. And that person is important. And also, like you had mentioned, you have to have a tremendous amount of respect and trust for each other. So I have to trust them that what they're saying to me, what they're calling, they haven't gotten lost in the book, because that does happen quite frequently. And they're calling out things that are not what you're seeing and not going on. And they say, oh, sorry, I'm lost, right? Sometimes they're prideful and they don't tell you they're lost and they're trying to catch up and you're saying, what's going on? So, and also danger. I mean, they can change what they say to make you drive slower, right? So then you're less competitive. And so you both have to have the same appetite for danger, for risk, both have the same competitive nature. All those things are really important.
Wow. Yeah. So, I mean, it sounds like even though you think of a race car driver as like, it's one person, it's not, it's you, it's your navigator and your team. So I think that's pretty incredible. And you haven't done so bad for yourself in these races, which is also, you know, an incredible feat too. And I think it was in 2013 when you did your first, where you were race. And I think, and I hope I don't mispronounce this, but is it La Carriera Panamericana? How do you say that? I know I've butchered it.
It's okay. So it's a Mexican race starting in 1950. It's the La Carrera Panamericana, and it's a 7-day, 2,000-mile race.
Wow. What was that like?
Frightening. So 2013 was the first year I went down in my own car with my own team. I'd gone down the year before just to put my feet in the water to see what is this that I'm getting myself into. And in fact, in that race, there was a fatality on the first morning, and cars were going off cliffs, which is not uncommon. I mean, this race has a 30% attrition rate of people that don't finish on the final day because of bad accidents or health problems, whatever. And literally I was, it was so frightening that I was shaking uncontrollably. So I would be at the start and they'd be counting down the clock and you're watching it go from 9, 8, 7, 6, you know, on the seconds, and you know, you're going to be going flat out and you know, you're on a dangerous road and you know, there's a lot of unknowns, right? And you know, you have no experience and you don't know what you're doing. So yeah, literally my whole body was shaking uncontrollably. But then as I got going within, seconds, minutes, that's gone. And you're just so focused. And in that zone, you're no longer frightened until the next start at the next road that they've closed off that they're doing it. But yeah, starting the mornings on my knees in prayer. And yeah, definitely something I had to overcome was that fear.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine that is, I mean, because I suspect if you have fear in a job like you have, you actually can't do your job.
No, and you know, I've learned that you really need to use that fear, right? So it's overcoming that fear and it's harnessing that emotion and that visceral kinds of thing that's happening with you in your mind and your body. If you can master that and use that and employ that in what you're actually doing, it gives you a competitive edge and it gives you a focus mentally that's really amazing. And you can't be second guessing yourself whether you're going into a corner too fast or not, or your mind has to be totally engaged in that moment, in that very, very moment. Or if you're thinking about something else because of fear or whatever, yeah, lights out, not a good idea.
Yeah, for sure. I'd like to talk a minute actually about then, as you're gearing up for a race, whether it's a 2013 one or another one, when you're thinking about what does success look like for you coming out of a race? Is it winning? Is it finishing it? Is it like, what do you think about when you think about what is going to make a successful race?
Well, for me, first of all, it's a team sport. And so the experience of us as a team is super important, that everybody, you know, went through that experience together, giving it their all with enthusiasm and also just having this a great esprit de corps. Having that esprit de corps is so important to me, and that when we finish, that there's that camaraderie, that there's that sense of accomplishment, no matter whether we were on the podium or not, but we did our very best. And there's amazing relationships that I've developed through all this with these special people that are on our team. And so that would be like number one, I would think of just how we did and how much we gave it of our all and that sense of accomplishment in that area. And then, of course, you know, hey, always you want to be on the podium. That's always the best. That's always the goal, right? To get on that podium. Sometimes the races we've put ourselves in Project 356, we know we're not going to be on the podium, and that can't be the goal, because we tie our philanthropic drive for doing something about child trafficking in with our racing in this project. So we know we can't be as competitive. So we have to have other goals of what does that look like to be successful. And so it's just, you know, charting out what those goals are for that event and then striving to achieve those. And if we do, or come really darn close to it, or did our best to get there, that's success.
That's awesome. I think that's a really great way of looking at it as well. And in a second, I want to talk a little bit more about Project 356, but I have a question first that I'm curious about, and that is, as a woman and a predominantly male field, you know, like, you've inspired many people. I've read lots of articles on you now and seen different things, and I was just wondering, what is it like to be a woman in a field that is largely male? And what would you say to other women who are thinking of taking on a new challenge in maybe something that it typically isn't a women-driven profession?
When I first started racing, just to tell you that how much I didn't know about car racing was, I didn't know it was a male sport or a male-dominated sport. It wasn't even on my radar. So when I went down that first year and I was looking around the room with all the drivers, there was probably 90, you know, drivers in the room, and I was looking to meet some other ladies and everything, and I'm thinking, well, where are they? Is when it dawned on me that I was in a male sport. But it wasn't one of those things I've even thought about or think that much about now at all. It's I don't think you should actually. But for me, I never, especially when I've been racing in Mexico those first 4 or 5 years, I never was felt like I was being treated differently. I never looked at myself as a woman driver, and I never viewed myself as a woman driver. It was Joy's, I'm just another driver. We are all drivers doing this thing together. And I think even that maybe would have been something that added to our having success, is because I don't think that should be our focus. You know, whatever you're doing, whether it's a male dominated arena or not, it's who you are as a person and what you're bringing to the table, what your talents are, what your strengths are, what your weaknesses are, all those things about you that you're coming. And my gender doesn't come into play in that. And that doesn't mean, you know, when something happens and I look around and I realize out of 300 drivers in one event, I was the only woman, that you go, oh, you don't pause and say, take note of that. But it can't be your focus, and it isn't my focus. And I think, anyway, that's my opinion on it. And I, what would I say? Don't look at that. Don't think about, oh, I'm the only woman, because you're putting yourself in a one down kind of situation in a way mentally, right? You're thinking you have something you have to overcome, which maybe you don't have to overcome. Maybe those people that you're going to be working with or competing against don't look at you as a woman. Maybe they do, maybe they don't, but you have no idea. So why even put that out there as something that's an issue or something that you have to overcome?
I love that. I think that's a great way to look at it. So now I would like to talk a little bit about what you're currently doing and, you know, the cause that you've chosen to get behind and why you did. Okay, so let's talk about Project 356. Tell us about what this is and why you're doing it.
We ended up, you know, I started this whole racing right thinking I was going to do this one time. I got to go do that thing. So I can't say I didn't do it or try. And then that would be it. But then it got a life of its own. It totally changed my life. And it changed my family. And it started, I realized it was impacting other people's lives. So we kept racing, right? And then we were having all the success in Mexico, and we were either winning, you know, or coming in second in our class and doing super great in the overall standings, and thought, you know, we have this little voice and we have a heart for change. So how can we couple those together and have a bigger voice and have a bigger impact for change? And so that's how we created Project 356. So we decided to take the car on a global stage and put it in environments where there'd never, ever been that kind of car before, or never been a woman before, or whatever combination of those firsts that we could come up with. And also they had to be really challenging, really authentic, challenging, bona fide races. They couldn't be, quote, powder puff events. They had to be things that would gain it, that if aren't being involved with them, there was a lot of credibility. And so that's how it all started. And our heart was for to doing something for kids that are being trafficked, and primarily sex trafficked, but also labor trafficked. And so we just coupled those two together. And the goal is to take the car on every continent and race it, which we've done 6 continents so far. And we have one left. It's Antarctica.
Antarctica. Wow. That's and when do you do that one?
Well, we were slated for this winter because of COVID travel restrictions. We haven't been able to go. And so we're slated to go in December of 2021.
Wow. Okay. I mean, and it's such a credible cause. And you've raised quite a bit of money for this cause as well, which is fantastic. So what has the reception been like when people hear that this is why you're racing?
Well, when you learn... First of all, when you're putting yourself in events where there hasn't been a woman or hasn't been that kind of car, you're an anomaly, right? So people start asking you questions, and that provides the opportunity of talking about why you're doing it, right? And when people learn about the issue of child trafficking, once you've heard, you can't say you haven't heard, right? And it's such a terrible, awful thing, and it grips people's hearts, and then there's this appreciation for what we're doing and why we're doing it. And then, you know, also there's this whole thing of inspiring women. We'll find at the end of a day, we didn't start this to inspire anybody, right? It was fulfilling a one-liner. And then at the end of the day, you'll find 15 women or girls, all ages, from little kids to grandmas waiting for you and cheering for you when you come in at the end of a day of racing and thanking you for doing that and thanking you for inspiring them as a woman in their country and their culture, that they can do things outside of the box or that other people say they can't do, right? So there's all these amazing things that come out of it, but there's just usually appreciation, yet we always feel like we're the ones on the receiving end because of the love and then having the opportunity to be able to do something and being entrusted with people's money that they donate, that we're able to vet organizations and donate that money. There's such a feeling of humbleness because we're able to be the conduit for that. And then being involved actually in doing investigative work, all these kinds of things. I just feel like I'm the one that's getting blessed through all this, but I hope I answered your question.
Absolutely you did. And, you know, it's funny because, well, it's not funny, but I think human trafficking and especially, you know, children, it's such a widespread issue. Like, I think a lot of people think, well, it's never going to happen to my kids. I don't live in a kind of place where that happens, but it actually happens everywhere. And and social media has made it even more pronounced in how people are getting their victims. So Renee, I'd love to ask, with Project 356, what is your goal there? What are you hoping to achieve in terms of your fundraising?
So we have a couple of goals. One is obviously to raise awareness, because at first it starts with educating people that there's even this problem. And then the other thing is a financial goal. Our goal is to raise $1 million by the time we're finished racing on every continent. To date, we've raised $270,000. And something I think is important that people realize is Valkyrie Gives is our 501c3, and it's totally separate than the racing. And all the money we collect all goes out, every single dollar. We have no overhead. We have no expenses. If we throw a fundraiser, that's separate. You know, we pay for that through the racing. So we're a conduit. We're a conduit. And we vet grassroots organizations around the world that are, some people are literally risking their lives and have risked their lives to do something about rescuing kids and finding the perpetrators, throwing them in jail and disrupting that business, right? Which can make people very angry. So that's what we do. We find grassroots organizations on the front lines that are doing the amazing work effectively, that are responsible with how the money is being used and are making a difference. And we spend a lot of time vetting them. And then we give those monies that are given to us and donate to them to those organizations.
Well, what an incredible cause. And to everyone listening, if you check out our show notes, you'll be able to find a link in there where you can go find out more information about how you can potentially donate if you would like to. So I think it's just incredible what you're doing. And I'm just curious, in this process of going through all of these continents and these races, do you have any, like, a couple aha moments that you had, whether it was about, you know, that, yes, I've done the right thing here, this is, we should be doing it, or just an experience you had that really kind of changed your outlook on something, or just like a really, that was a cool moment?
Just like racing was something that I ended up doing not because I wanted to. This whole thing of child trafficking wasn't something I chose. I met a guy in the FBI who works as an undercover agent to find people making child pornography with really little kids, kids that are too little to talk, actually. And he was telling me how prevalent it is in our country and then about the global problem and how that feeds into child trafficking, right? Because what they see, then they want to act on, et cetera. And then realizing, like you said, it's affecting people from all different economic backgrounds, rural, urban, poor, rich, whatever, right? All races, all countries, everywhere. And feeling in so many ways that I'm just living what I'm supposed to be doing, right? So when I heard about that, learned about that, and started researching it, was like, wow, that's terrible. You know, I would like to do something about it, but not knowing what that looked like and still sort of on the fence. And then shortly after that introduction, I was on a bus going to pick up a rental car and sat down next to this man and just glanced over, and on his phone was an image of a very young child, a child pornography image on his phone. And he quickly did a screen swipe or did something so I couldn't see that, right? And there was this weird kind of vibe going on. And I thought, this is too weird. You know, I've had these two things happen to me in this short amount of time. And I just had this sense I'm supposed to be doing something about it. And So for me, it's all of this is, it's like living out, I just have a sense of purpose that I'm not, there's nothing you have to gin up. It's in there. It's in your heart. It's in your thoughts. It's in your being. And you're just letting it come out and you're living it out. And of course, there's such a satisfaction in knowing that. And then you're always reevaluating, am I doing what I'm supposed to be doing? And then you realize, yeah, you know, and so the people's affirmation or their encouragement is always amazing. And it's, but it has to come from inside, right? And having that peace inside, you're doing what you're supposed to be. So I think it's, those are those things that are affirming.
So the name of your race is Valkyrie Racing. That's who you race under. You are the founder of it. I would just love to know, what is the meaning behind that name?
When we were deciding, okay, we need a name. We're this team going down there racing and we're having this success. What do we call ourselves, right? It was this quest to match who we are and what we were doing. And I heard about Valkyries and thought, that's it. You know, let's call ourselves Valkyrie Racing. And for those of you who don't know, Valkyries are women warriors from Norse mythology. And they came from Valhalla, which is their heaven, and they would go to the battlefield and they'd rescue the wounded and the dying that were worthy. And they'd return them to the heaven and they'd restore life. And we thought we would, you know, in our heart, we want to be modern day Valkyries. And so that's how we came up with Valkyrie Racing.
That's incredible. I love that story. And really, I have one final question, and it's a question we keep consistent among all of our guests. And it's really, if you could go back in time and talk to yourself at a younger age, what would the conversation look like? What kind of advice would you give?
Wow. Here's what I would say, and I hope I can present this in the right way, especially as a woman. I think, I'm not saying men aren't this way, but especially as women, we tend to many times make sacrifices for our children and our families that go beyond what we should maybe be doing. We want to give them our all, our heart, our time and everything. And I ended up homeschooling our four kids, and it was right at the beginning of homeschooling, and it wasn't, again, something I purposed to do. I just said, oh, I'll do this for 1 year. It was a more of a necessity because our son was advanced, and it was just seemed like a more healthy kind of environment after he wasn't fitting in with his age group at school. And I was going to do for maybe a year, right? And it ended up homeschooling all of our kids and a life of doing that. But in the process of doing that, I really shut down all my own development, my own pursuits, and my own yearnings as a young woman. And I was a pre-med student when I got married, and I ended up starting a family shortly after that, and just put everything into my family, but to the extent that I wasn't keeping myself whole and happy. And it was inside, you would have never have known it, but I really believe that's why this whole one-liner was going on that I wasn't aware of, that one day I'm going to do X. And so I would just encourage them to, yes, it, you know, it's true that saying, it's more blessed to give than receive. And there is something amazing about giving that we also receive, but to not do that to the extent of negating everything in your own heart and all your own passions and your own development, to allow time for yourself and don't ever feel guilty about that. You know, there has to be a balance. So just to keep that perspective.
That's awesome. That's great. And that actually brings us to the end of our formal questions. And then I have three additional quick questions that we just ask, good source of information for our listeners. And that is really the first question there is just, what's your favorite podcast or source of information?
So I love to meet people who've had firsthand experiences of tragedies in life or war or things of history, historical moments, and just to capture those, because how about, I don't know about you, but I wish I would have asked my parents more questions before they died about things they had gone through in, you know, being in the military in war or going through the depression or all those things to learn from them, right? So if there are people that are living now that your paths cross, to grab that moment in time and to ask them questions as you can, right? If they'll let you, and just to learn from them, what can you take away from their experiences? And then I love reading nonfiction, investigative kind of books to learn from those. Those would be my sources.
That's cool. That's awesome. What are you currently reading?
I'm reading a book by Roberto Saviano, who's an Italian author who's actually an investigative reporter who is writing about, he's written at least two books, and he writes about how illegal business, so for instance, child trafficking, human trafficking is a $150 billion industry. That's illegal money, right? And that's mostly cash. A lot of times that's mostly cash money. And that is how it fuels the world economy, and governments and institutions and legitimate businesses are being fueled by illegitimate businesses. So drug trafficking's number one, human trafficking's number two. So he writes about drug trafficking and about how this commerce is funding and fueling worldwide and upholding so many economies in the world. It's just fascinating.
Wow. And my final question for you is, who is currently inspiring you?
Now, this may sound like a funny one. I don't know. I'm just going to say it. But during COVID, there have been so many people that have been living in fear. And my mom-in-law is 96 years old. And she has not an ounce of fear in this whole thing. And I just look at her. She's happier than ever. She doesn't want her life to stop. She wants to go out and socialize and be with family and be with friends. And the bummers in her life are that she can't go out because no one else will go out, and she wants to go out. So I think it's just looking at this person at the end of their life who knows what's important and still values those things and is still pursuing and loving those things. Her freedom, the joy, and the joy of family and the joy of friends and spending time together. She went to an event in the mountains, a music event where there were all these people. She's out there. She's not COVID afraid. You know, she still goes and gets her hair done all those things. So I think just looking at someone who one would think should be the most fearful, because it would be the most impacting on their life and they would be the most at risk, but yet having still such a free spirit. So
I think that's amazing. I think it's very, that's amazing. Thank you. And I just want to thank you, Renee, so much for taking time out of your day to come and chat with me for an episode of Run It Like a Girl. I'm really thrilled, and I know everyone is just going to love this episode. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Thanks a lot.
Run It Like a Girl is hosted by Bonnie Moak. Brian Long is the producer. Web design and technical assistance provided by Dan Moak. And music courtesy of the talented Brooklyn Gillichuk.